Colonel Bragg, room 2.
As I was saying just now, one of the most important things we had hammered into us was this question of getting the Indian magistrate present and getting him to sign that he called in the military in aid of the civil and that he had lost control. They did their best not to sign. You did your best to get him to sign, and you could only simply say, no signature, no action, until finally got out of control. And your problem was to keep your soldiers out of reach of the mobs, or what they were, then usually a great howling mob by that stage before the magistrate would sign, to keep your soldiers away from this, to stop them being from getting overwhelmed before the magistrate signed. Immediately you got his signature, then you went racing into action and got the announcements going as quickly as you can by a megaphone, by displaying a sort of portable placard thing saying advance no further or we shoot. And you did everything you could to ensure that their mobs were warned. If you didn't get the signature, you, of course, could be in the most terrible trouble, because if anybody was killed or hurt, you could be head up in the Indian courts, and you probably would not receive very sympathetic treatment. So this was a very great must. We hadn't got any of the aids that one has nowadays, as I mentioned just now, but you detailed off a special orderly to record everything in writing of what happened. His job was to get everything down on paper, and this was essential too, because if anything happened again, you might be questioned afterwards or head up in the courts. You had a written record of somebody who was doing nothing else but this. And then, of course, eventually, you might actually have to get down to actually giving the order of fire. We were trained fairly well. We were particularly... I don't know if my regiment was typical or not, but we did have to study what had happened previously, and the famous case, I've forgotten which one it was, at Lahore, of the general, so-and-so, who was in disgrace and was head up and later on in Parliament and disgraced because of what he had done. And so we went back into history, and I think we were fairly well trained as to what our job was, and we had a drill within the platoon too. And then if the dreaded moment came, you were then taught that there's no point ever in shooting over their heads. This is the worst thing you could do, because if there's going to be any deterrent at all, it was a fear that you would open fire and kill them. If, on the other hand, they saw you open fire and nobody fell down wounded or killed, then that deterrent obviously was no longer credible. And so you were taught under no circumstances ever do this. You had to be very ruthless indeed and get the men to fire, but you had to pick out with two or three soldiers and detail off the man you were going to hit, and then you fired low to hit that particular man. This may sound brutal, but it was the only way, if you were faced with howling mobs of many tens of thousands possibly, in which you could make your presence as a very small number of soldiers felt against this big mob. It was a deterrent, and once it went into action, it had to be seen to be a deterrent.
How would you choose the man at whom you would be aiming?
Usually you would pick out a leader, I think this is fair enough, and you aim low with the object of wounding him. And if you got him in the legs, okay, he'd fall down. I think this was a very fair way of doing it. And the only thing you could do was to pick out, as I said, somebody who was gesticulating or obviously leading the rest. And then you picked out your best shots to open fire.
Whilst you were training to go up onto the frontier, you said you got very fit. Did you do any route marching in Meerut?
Yes, we hastened our program because we were given, we accelerated because we were ordered to go up to the Northwest Frontier before our time. I don't know how much earlier, I think it was about 6 to 9 months earlier than we expected, because a regiment, in fact it was the Argonne Southern Highlanders, had unfortunate experiences up there, and they were being brought down before their time, and so we were being ordered up beforehand, and so this pace of training was accelerated. Mostly it was this right marching, and whereas we were quite normally used to getting up early in the morning, and you led a very healthy, fit life in those days. You were up frightfully early and you did a lot of exercise before breakfast, either playing games with your men or exercising horses, or both. In this case, at least once a week, we would go for a right march, gradually building up the distance, 10 miles, 15 miles, 20 miles, 25 miles, up to 30. Before breakfast, you would set off. I wouldn't like to say what time it was, it's too long ago to remember the exact timing, but you went off really literally in the dark just before dawn when it was cooler. And as you, of course, you went longer and longer distances, you didn't come back till the heat of the day. And this was very, very trying. As fit youngsters, I think one survived it, you felt the strain. But inevitably, there was the odd casualty or two amongst the men as the pace got tougher and tougher. Heat stroke, I'm not quite certain how you differentiate these medically, but when people got very, very hot, you got a sort of heat stroke effect, where a chap faints and passes out, but he's revived by being made cooler. But if you seem to go to a stage beyond that, you get a heat exhaustion kind of state, we call it, where, in fact, a chap passed out and fainted, but when you got into hospital because he didn't come round, his body temperature had dropped. And I remember being terrified. I had two men in my platoon who were in this state, and we managed to get them back to intermittent from this right march, and I went to see them in the hospital as soon as I'd seen my platoon back in again. And to my amazement, on a stinking hot day in the hundreds, there were these men with blankets on and hot water bottles all around them, trying to heat up their bodies back to normal. And I was very frightened. It impressed me and depressed me to see this state of heat exhaustion, which I knew nothing about. I didn't think many of us did know much about it at that time.
You say the casualties were physical. Did you ever have any kind of mental casualties amongst the men at all in India?
That's an interesting point, because I've seen some of that since the war in overseas stations. I don't ever remember this happening at all in my time in India before the war. I don't know a single case of true mental troubles. I had seen cases of DTs and drinking. Whether you classify that in your question or not, I don't know. The drinking business, I think, was a way of life almost in those days. And again, it may be a reflection of society at the time. Men drank fairly heavily. Maybe they do nowadays. I think they drink probably less nowadays. This may be economic, it may be a healthier way of living, I don't know, but certainly drinking was quite a big thing in India, and the longer people stayed there, perhaps the more they were inclined to turn to drink. This may have been loneliness, it may have been separation from their home country for many years, a form of solace of some sort. And people who were not in groups that moved around. I must differentiate here. I'm not trying to slang the Indian services or anything, but obviously those people who came to India temporarily, like us, went through an experience. This experience affected you a little or a lot, but it was not there. You realized that soon you were going to be out of it, whether you liked it or not. It was going to come to an end. If you were there in Indian forces, you were there. And you saw no change happening. You were going to be there for the rest of your life till you retired. And there was no break except looking ahead to your next leave in England, which may be God knows how far ahead. And so one did see a lot of this drinking going on amongst, for example, one might say the Indian Medical Service. I'm not picking them out because they are the only people. Right? It happened amongst many other people who stayed in India a long time. It happens to have been the experience I personally happen to have seen. And if a doctor was out in India in a station in the Indian Medical Service, he was there for a long, long time. And I think this probably led to unconsciously some form of despair, and probably extra turning to drinking. And I actually, as a young officer at one stage, for example, had to help guard an army doctor with DTs. And it was a very shocking experience for a young man. I didn't know what it was to stay with this chap and stay up with him all night and was quite a shocking experience. But as mental cases, I didn't actually come across true psychiatric cases at all then.
Did you have a problem with keeping your men from being bored? Was it a special problem in any way?
I'm having to think over that one. Sorry for the delay on this, but no. We say the problem, yes, of course there was a problem, because you were not actively taking part in anything, and your purpose that you were in India for was something fairly remote to them, to us all, in fact. And therefore, you latched on to the one thing that we all went through, and this drive was from the top downwards, and that was keep fit. The more exercise you take, the better. And I think this was an absolute religion there. It was probably right, looking back on it, but the soldier, from the time he woke up in the morning with the bugle blowing the valley, he really had no rest at all, except for a couple of hours in the afternoon, when we all broke off, and again after round about sunset. He went out early morning parade, and they were very early, and he played games or he did some training before he had his breakfast. And by then, he wanted a good meal. He had a pretty good meal. The food was quite good. Then he had the morning's work going through till about 1:30, maybe 2. And then there was lunch. And then the afternoon, nothing, until round about 4:30 or so. Exact timings would vary in different stations and different regiments and different climates. But round about the tea time, if you like, then there was a tea, and then they did either more sports again or possibly training. It was much more likely to be sports, except when you were being serious and getting ready to go up the northwest frontier the month or two before. And so he then really didn't finish until probably about 6 o'clock. And then his only recreation probably was to go and rest and then go along to Naffy and have drink. But in those days, spirit was not allowed, so all he did was to probably have an extra meal, and the Naffy was run by a contractor. He could get a cheap meal and he could drink beer. And that was closed, and again, the exact timing, I don't know, it would have been about 10 o'clock or 10:30, and as a young, oldly officer, you had to go along and close down the Naffy at that time. And that was the end of the day for him. So as long as you kept him fully occupied, and when I say him, I mean ourselves, because we were the same boat exactly, I suppose time passed moderately. But definitely there was a danger of boredom, yes.
Were spirits banned for the officers as well as the men?
No. The officers' mess and sergeants' mess were allowed spirits in this tradition. It was not peculiar to India or anything like that. That was common throughout the whole British Army, right up to post-war. And it's only in comparatively recent years that spirits have been allowed to everybody in the Naffy. Before that, it was confined to officers and sergeants mess only.
Coming on to the frontier campaigns in which you were involved, can you tell me which they were?
They were the Waziristan 1936-37 and Waziristan 37-38. And they were concerned with the rising of the Waziris and the Momans together. They're two major tribes in the northwest frontier of India, and normally they fight amongst themselves as well as fighting against whoever was the governing power. But in those two particular campaigns, they both rose together against the British Raj, and that's why it was probably one of the most difficult campaigns to handle from the top point of view of the lot, because there were inadequate forces to hold down such a large part of the frontier, or to be punitive. And therefore, as far as I know, when I haven't studied all the history of the world at that time, it seemed to me about the first time which we tried to use the air power, such as it was there, as one of the army power, insofar as that while we were after, say, the Waziris, they were trying to use aircraft to go and bomb villages of the Momans. And on the whole, my impression was it didn't work. That's why there were two different campaigns. When I said two different campaigns, they didn't appear to be different campaigns to us. They just merged into one long campaign. We went up originally to replace the Argonne Southern Highlanders in the Sham Plain. That was in either late 36. Late 37. And this was with the Gurkha Brigade, because Gurkha Brigades normally had, like all Indian brigades, had one British battalion in them. And so we were the one British battalion in the Gurkha Brigade in the Sham Plain. After that, we went to Rusmuk. And with Rusmuk as a base, we belonged to what was called Ruskol, Rusmuk Column, which went out on columns from Rusmuk into different parts of Waziristan to try and counter the attacks of the Fakir of Ipi, who used to come in, do attacks on different villages, take them over. The scouts, there were three lots of different scout regiments up there at the time, and the political officers who worked together, they would do their best, they would supply the information, and finally we might have to go out as a column and ensure that that whole valley was restored back again into our control. The Fakir VP carried out a form of guerrilla warfare. He'd withdraw. If necessary, he'd withdraw back into Afghanistan over the border where we weren't supposed to be able to touch him, wait till we got back to Rusmuk, and then come in again. So it was a typical guerrilla warfare against the British normal conventional kind of operation. And so obviously it due to be prolonged for some time. The important people there were the political officers and the scouts, who had a very difficult time, and most of us respected them highly. The scouts were most efficient, very romantic in a way. The political officers, I think, had a highly dangerous game to play as go-in-betweens. We weren't always sympathetic with them. They weren't loved by probably either side, but they certainly had a pretty rough job to do, and those that I did meet, I had the greatest respect for.
What did you mean when you said you weren't supposed to go after the Fakir of Ipi into Afghanistan?
Well, obviously, to cross any international border would be creating terrible problems to the diplomatic and everybody else as to why you're going across into some other country. We never did, except possibly on one occasion when we had a special light column. We thought we'd got the Fakir. We had intelligence to chase him. A special light column was selected from each regiment. We chose so many men. I was lucky enough to get on the light column, and we did a rush up into the hills, and we missed him to a degree that in one place we rushed into a village. The fireplaces were still hot. The summer fires were still burning. The Fakir had just managed to make a getaway. He went across the border, and we actually, I suppose, did cross into the border for the odd mile or two, trying to catch him, but we didn't, and then had to withdraw. It was a minor infringement of the border at that time, and they did their typical act. We then had to withdraw back to Rusmuk. First of all, we had to withdraw the light column back to the main column, and the main column had to get back, and whether it was the Fakir or not, but certainly the forces that we had against us, the Waziris, did follow us up very strongly indeed, and we had quite a sticky time getting out with the light column. And we did take part in the most unusual show at one stage. The column commander decided to actually pull out from one valley to join the main column at night. This night operating had never been done before. This was chiefly because it was realized that being locals and guerrillas, the Waziris would always have the advantage at night over conventional type forces, such as we were. And therefore, we were never trained to operate at night, except to stay put. You stay put. You put up a big wall, a stone wall around you, and you put up barbed wire around that. Anything that moves, you shoot. But in this particular case, we moved a complete light column at night, and it was a new tactic, a new maneuver, and I think we were all very concerned that night as to what was going to happen. But I think whoever organized this did very well, because it had the element of surprise. The Pathans did not expect us to operate at night. and therefore they weren't ready for it, and therefore it happened almost without incident. But I'll never remember that, because going through that night, it was with mules as your only form of transport. Your guns were carried on mules, the mountain guns, or your ammunition, everything that you live on, your food, everything else was carried on mules, trying to get these mules to go up these very steep hills indeed, and some of them would literally fall over backwards with the burdens they were carrying and the vertical nature of the hill you were going up. The scree, as they call it in the Lake District, the sort of loose stones, the noise you made, this feeling you had the whole time, the batons would come out at any moment and with their knives. It was a very exciting night, that. But we got away with it by sheer surprise. If the batons had any idea of what was going to happen, I think we would have had a very bad morning indeed. We did have a deception campaign insofar as that the previous evening we all pretended we were going to go to bed and stay there. This is for the sake of all our people, like the contractors who had with you, all the necessary Indians that you had to have supporting you as civilians. We suspected them and was passing the information. And I'm certain if they had thought that we were going to go through over the hills that night, that would have got out to batons. But it worked, and we got away with that without casualty.
You said earlier that you and the other officers rather questioned the attitudes of the political officers towards the batons. Can you enlarge on that?
Well, we thought they were far too friendly with the batons, because after all you were fighting them and they killed you. The very first person killed in the whole in my regiment was my own company commander, standing right beside me after only about a week of the second campaign we were on. And so, and I also lost in my platoon 4 killed and 10 wounded. And to lose your own men like that and your own company commander, you really felt you were fighting the enemy. No question of necessary emotion about it. They were the enemy, and this is the way you bring up soldiers, to fight and kill the enemy. The particular officer saw that as being saw it from a totally different point of view. He had to stay on and live there when the campaign was over. Not live there, but stay and work there. And he was much more sympathetic to what we called the enemy, and we thought that he was with the enemy. And we, as younger officers, or I suppose as fighting soldiers as a whole, did not like even letting these political officers know what we were going to do, because we thought that we couldn't trust him not to pass on this information to these batons, the enemy. And I suppose perhaps the batons saw him equally as being a bad type, because there he was going amongst them, and perhaps he was passing information. He was a white man, after all, belonging to the British Raj, passing information to us. So I think they were not popular with either side. And one particular incident happened where we'd managed to capture and bring in some of the dead we'd killed, the batons, which was always a big thing to do, because they never left their dead. And we had them there for people to see, and along came a political officer in full hearing of all, quite a number of British officers as well as Gurkha, British soldiers as well as Gurkha, said every dead Bataan lying there is a dead friend of mine. I'm certain he was a very nice chap, and he was doing his job nobly, and what he said may have had meant something to him, but he should not have said that in front of British soldiers who just lost some of their own comrades killed by these very Bataans. And this is the sort of incident that didn't help.
What did you think of the Batons against whom you were fighting?
I think most of us on the whole thought they were rascals, sometimes likeable. Their treachery was a thing that went against our sort of British code of behaviour. They seemed to us to be very treacherous people. Looking back in it, I think they had a code of behaviour of their own which we didn't understand, and I've had it explained to me since. And they lived according to their code, but we didn't think that code, if they had one, was an honourable one, and so very often they were hated. I think the sort of way of behaviour we didn't like was that they would pass you and greet you with a smile on the face, But when they turned a corner, they'd go up to the nearest hill and they'd try and shoot you to kill you. So, firstly, you felt you couldn't trust any Pathan. When they gained a certain amount of respect amongst our soldiers, they were ridiculously brave, to the degree of not being brave, but being stupid. I mean, there'd be quite a battle with an unseen enemy. And they were extremely efficient at this kind of work, behind stones, behind boulders. They'd be shooting at you, and it'd be very difficult to locate them. On other occasions, they'd leap up and down the top of a hill, waving their rifles up in the air, in a sort of dare me kind of attitude, asking to be shot. And you almost felt sorry, you know, to sort of turn your guns on to your mountain guns or your machine guns and say, aim at those people, because they were just being very stupid. I didn't think we killed many like that, because I think after the first few bursts, you know, they died behind a rock. But they did try to display their bravery, and for this kind of work, our men, I think, respected them occasionally. What gained them hatred was, I can't think of the right word, the defining of bodies. If ever they got hold of a British wounded man, they could make certain that he died in a very slow and nasty way. That I could go into if you wanted me to, but if they then his body, or if they killed a person, his body, they would then defile. And this goes to their religion to a certain degree, that this is a form of obscene defiling, because in their religion, if the body is defiled, the soul can't go to heaven. And they do this to one another, so perhaps we shouldn't have objected to it quite so much. But it's something that the British just find most beastly, and it really got the soldiers backed up more than anything else. If it hadn't been for this defiling of bodies, I think there could have been a sneaking liking for the Pathan.